Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you today from early in the new year. It's 2020, and both us in Vancouver and my colleague in Hamilton on the other side of the country are bracing for real winter weather to come very soon. But by the time you hear this, it is hopefully quite nice wherever you're listening from. The colleague I was just alluding to is Leslie Martin, who's a general internist at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, and also deputy program director for their core internal medicine residency program. And I have the pleasure today of chatting with her about work that was done for her master's thesis. It'll be published in the April issue of Medical Education 2020 under the title The Impact of Entrustment Assessments on Feedback and Learning, Trainee Perspectives. Thanks, Leslie. I know you've only moved to Hamilton relatively recently, but it's nice to talk to a fellow Hamiltonian.
Thank you so much for having me.
It really is a pleasure because the focus of this work is on, first of all, a hot topic, but I was intrigued by the paper in part because of the way it starts to move discussion about entrustable professional activities into another realm that's more common in other forms of assessment, which is thinking about how they might be used for learning. So maybe I'll just start and ask you, what made that connection for you? What was it about entrustable professional activities that led you to believe it needed to be considered separately from other forms of assessment that people have considered as opportunities for directing growth?
Yeah, so as I'm sure most listeners are aware, within our Canadian context, post-medical graduate education programs are transitioning towards competency-based medical education. And within Canada, that has involved designing entrustable professional activities, or EPAs, for all programs across the country. For those not familiar, these are tasks that are felt to capture the core work of our training programs and are supposed to integrate the competencies in a more meaningful way for our faculty. And the EPAs have been designed into workplace-based assessments. So I think that's kind of connecting with what you were saying, that they're similar to, but somewhat different from previous literature around workplace-based assessments. And these have been designed to be evaluated using an entrustment scale or a construct-aligned scale using trust as the anchor. And these low-stakes assessments are to be integrated in order to help guide higher-stakes promotional decisions. And so I think the reason we really wanted to look at EPAs is a lot of the workplace-based assessment literature was often framed more in the formative assessment or assessment for learning sphere. And now we are moving more towards using those assessments to guide higher stakes decisions. And it's been discussed in the literature in more reflective ways. What will that mean? And now that we have no longer any zero stakes assessments or no stakes assessments, what is that implication for learning for our trainees that are going through and getting these, but knowing that they're going to be related to their promotion throughout their training? So the dual stakes of a workplace-based assessment.
Thanks. You mentioned people who might not be perfectly familiar with EPAs. With them in mind, can I ask you to say a little bit more about, I guess, specifically how you're using them and how an EPA differs from some of those other forms of assessment that you just alluded to?
Yeah, so the EPAs within Canada have been written at kind of stages of training. So when you first enter a training program in the early phases, you'll have more basic skills or tasks that you are expected to perform. And that has been written along a continuum or a competence continuum progression throughout your training to more complicated tasks towards the end of your training. So for example, in internal medicine, a core EPA might be around assessing, diagnosing, managing patients with complex, atypical acute medical presentations, whereas earlier on it would be more common presentations. And the difference between these tasks and other workplace-based assessments, such as the mini-CEX wouldn't necessarily be written or constructed around a particular task. And as we move towards competency-based education, which is comes from the roots of outcomes-based education, we're often using these tasks as some of the outcomes that we anticipate our trainees should be able to perform by the time they're done their 2 to 5 years of training, depending on the program that they're in. And then we have linked them with a scale so that people can, at the end of that, say, yes, you were entrusted for this, reflected by a numeric component on a scale, as well as narrative feedback that can be provided at the time of this workplace-based assessment. So it is designed quite differently than previous workplace-based assessments, and to lend itself towards moving people through competency continuums into independent practice.
The broader literature, even on feedback, starts getting into issues about how to maximize or optimize the degree to which learning occurs in assessment context. Really does require a degree of trust on the part of the learner that the system offering the feedback is credible. And when they feel threat of various forms, there can be a tendency for us to not take away as much as we could from these sorts of opportunities. When you start getting into an assessment realm where it's very explicitly based on does the supervisor trust the learner, I can easily imagine those interactions become even more complex and complicated. Did you anticipate any particular response with respect to how learners were using EPAs for the sake of their own development?
So this study was conducted in the early transition to competency-based medical education in the early introduction of these tools. So I had a sense that there would be a lot of unfamiliarity at the early part and a lot of kind of co-learning between the faculty and the trainees as they're trying to use these tools in the early phases in a way that they've never used workplace-based assessments before. And I asked them to compare to previous workplace-based assessments that they might have experienced. So two of our focus groups contained PGY1 trainees, or first-year postgraduate trainees, who may have had experiences in their medical school years. And then two of the groups were higher-level PGY4 trainees in fellowship programs. And interestingly, many of them didn't have a lot of comparative experiences. And I think that's well captured in the literature, in that many trainees going through, when they reflect back on their training, think they haven't been directly observed very often and they haven't had very many workplace-based assessments done. So this was a huge transition towards increasing frequency of workplace-based assessment and then using this trust language. So I wasn't totally sure what would come out of the results in the conversations, but I did have a feeling that there would be tensions that came forward because of this being such a new tool in the early transitional period and new language that nobody had really encountered before.
That word tension that you just used seems like a good description for what actually arose. You mentioned three key dilemmas that were faced by the implementation that you're just describing. Can you highlight for those listening what you found to be the key issues that needed to be overcome?
Yeah, so we did highlight kind of three key tensions, and we have a little figure in our paper to summarize those. The first being the tension between standardization and flexibility. And what I mean by that is standardization as the opportunity to highlight core components of what a trainee needs to be able to do by the end of their training. And so the trainees found that helpful as a goal, helpful in order to seek experiences. But what they also struggled with is flexibility or authenticity. So was the task that they were trying to be assessed on actually reflective of the complexity of the experience within the context that they were working? And they found that if it didn't properly capture the work that they were doing, there was a real tension between the value of that assessment as well as their learning outcomes around discussing their performance if it didn't really capture what they were doing. Another tension was around words versus numbers. Words being, you know, more narrative descriptions of how they did, which they found more meaningful, and the numbers caused them more stress, although for them they found to be not necessarily as meaningful. And there was different reasons for that. Some component of that was because the numbers didn't always align with the narrative that was provided, and so if there was a lack of alignment, that was very confusing for the learners. But they also felt a lot of stress around being successful, because they knew that they needed a certain entrustment score in order to be deemed capable to do that task independently. And so they felt a lot of anxiety around, you know, I want a 4 or 5. Yes, it's great that I'm learning around this, but I really do need to achieve a certain number in order to move forward in my training program. And the last was around the perceived goal. And I think there's been a lot of discussion in the literature around this, but is the goal of this really for learning, or is the goal of this for promotion? And if this goal is for promotion, I should be focused on being assessed on the things I did well on so that I can move forward through my training program. So those were kind of the three key tensions that came forward in this early implementation period of CBME using entrustment language and EPAs.
I can imagine those will be tensions that will be present through all phases of implementation. I realize and appreciate you're at the relatively early stage. There are things that seem almost inevitable in terms of the challenge that both learners and supervisors have in terms of engaging in these sorts of interactions and in what can feel like high-stakes environments. So I'm curious as to whether you heard anything about strategies whereby people were able to start towards resolving some of these tensions. And I guess just to use this specific example, most of the effort, as you alluded to earlier, around EPA development has early on focused on what are the key core EPAs that everybody within a particular training context needs to be able to accomplish. And so just going through that really does speak to the standardization issue that you described. As soon as you start getting into the idiosyncrasy or flexibility of students, does it take away from the program's need to assure that people have met the requirements? How are people grappling with things like that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think when this started, we were trying to define the outcomes. Where are we trying to get our learners to? But now people are mapping backwards and saying, okay, so what experiences do we need? And so one of our trainees brought up the idea of losing the experiential value of their rotations. Many of our systems are still set up in the block format. And should we be changing what blocks our trainees go through because of our outcomes that we've defined? And I think many of us would argue probably not. There's still some experiential value to rotating through a multitude of different specialties, even from a collegiality perspective, from understanding how the hospital works, things along those lines. So I do think we have to be cautious around how we're utilizing our outcomes that we've defined when we're designing our training process. And that was raised by some of the trainees. They recognized some of their rotations really were not EPA high yield rotations, but still of great value. So the trainees that had a good idea of understanding how EPAs fit into their entire training process, I think struggled less with the utilization of them as one component of their program of assessment. However, some trainees really became hyper-focused on the EPAs, and that's where I think they lost the bigger picture. Going back to your original question, though, in terms of other ways that trainees were grappling with this, I think they even identified that probably the stress around the EPAs would get better with time, particularly as they saw how these were integrated in a and reflected upon in meaningful ways through promotions, through competence committees, which I know you did a podcast on recently, and through their own kind of learning understanding of the process. I think that was one thing that they felt over time might get better. Early on, these tensions seemed quite high, but perhaps when they understand and see from the big picture over their full 5 years of training, it might not seem as high stakes or as great of a tension.
Interesting. Excellent. And that really speaks as well to thinking about how these fit in the broader program that you've established, both educationally and assessment-wise. If I heard you correctly, it does sound as though this has flagged up a variety of ways in which the resolutions that the people might want to work towards aren't necessarily a matter of changing this particular assessment protocol, but are more about thinking how it's integrated into other activities, and maybe the system itself can be reviewed to make sure there's some mutual support.
Yeah, exactly.
Which potentially opens up a very broad discussion. So in the interest of time and sticking to the particular contents of this paper, it's probably a good spot for us to wrap up. But do you have any sort of final words of advice for people who are interested in ensuring that their EPA system offers good feedback and learning as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think these tools have a lot of power. And I think it really has to do with how we're integrating them within the bigger picture, as you alluded to. And so I recognize across Canada, because this is a centrally decided upon process, there's been some pushback kind of across the country. But I do think there's great value in these assessments. And I think it's just important to understand every tool has limitations. And that's been well documented through medical education literature in the past. And so recognizing those limitations, balancing those tensions can really help optimize how we're using this from the perspective of trainee learning. And I'm hoping to do more work to understand this, as I mentioned within the paper, from the faculty perspective. As time goes on, as perspectives change, given around change management, how might those perspectives change and how might these tensions change as time goes on? So I'm hoping to continue to work on this and really grow our understanding of that intersection between workplace-based learning and workplace-based assessment in a program of assessment utilizing interestful professional activities.
Excellent. That is a great note to end on, as it really does exemplify the very useful and insightful comments embedded in this work. And even though it was focused on the particulars of EPAs in this transition, there really is a lot to take away from it. I very happily recommend it to anybody listening for more details, and look forward to seeing how that work yet to come continues to evolve.
Thank you so much for having me on to discuss it. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I wish you the best of luck. And we'll just finish, as always, by reminding those listening that if you want the details of the work we've been discussing, you'll find it in the April 2020 issue of Medical Education under the title of The Impact of Entrustment Assessments on Feedback and Learning, Trainee Perspectives, and Leslie Martin is the first author. Thanks again, Leslie, and enjoy the rest of your day.
You as well.